Educators, students and educational developments. Dublin City FM.
Hello, you're very welcome to this week's Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Coming up later on today's programme.
Putting a kid on the internet is the opposite of what we think of as education. And while I say it's, you know, I've already said it's certainly appropriate as a research tool in many ways, it's not, we can't equate putting kids into this information stream with the idea of education.
I'll bring you an interview with David Schenck about the glut of information that is hard to avoid in many of our lives these days and its impact on education. But first, as always, we go to this week's news. A major new report on the teaching of social, personal and health education and relationships and sexuality education in Irish post-primary schools was launched on Friday by the Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, Barry Andrews. At first glance, the report might sound like another run-of-the-mill government study, but this one actually derives from a peer-to-peer survey carried out by members of the Council of Dáil na n-Óg. About 350 Irish teenagers were interviewed by a group of their peers under the supervision of a professional researcher. Key among the report's findings is the fact that 74% of senior cycle students received no relationship and sexuality education classes during 2009. Students also reported RSE being taught in religion classes and by outside groups, sometimes providing information that was misguided and even homophobic. Barry Hennessy has been discussing the report's findings with Sheelan Yusufitsida, a member of the Dáil na n-Óg Council, who was involved as well in carrying out the survey.
The survey was, the idea for it basically came up about when one of the topics of this year's council was, you know, young people were saying that we think we should have more access to sex education, which is appropriate to us and, you know, comprehensive. So that's how the survey came about, because we felt that we were hearing these, you know, great things said by teachers that, oh, RSE is being taught, whereas we felt that it wasn't really being taught as well. So we basically wanted to investigate the implementation of RSE and SBHE, because we know the curriculum is out there, so we just wanted to see, you know, how is it being implemented. And we, all the members of the Dáil na n-Óg councils, were trained on how to carry out the survey. The survey was basically made by us, drafted by us, went, you know, through a few drafts through us, so it was comprehensive for young people to carry out this survey, basically, to answer the questions. And we were the young researchers that carried it out throughout the country.
Right. Now, as I was saying to you at the outset, obviously, it involves two particular subjects on the school curriculum, SPHE, which is social, personal and health education, and then RSE, which is relationship and sexuality education. Now, coming to SPHE, first of all, most students, it would seem, are indeed availing of this subject, but there's a degree of dissatisfaction regarding the way it's actually being taught.
Yes, the survey showed that 88% of the students we surveyed were getting had our SPHE in 2009, which is quite good, you know. And a majority of the young people, you know, said that it really helped develop their personal and social skills. But where the problem really arises is how the curriculum is being taught. And young people were saying, you know, they don't like getting fact sheets. They don't like going through textbooks. Majority were saying they like open discussions where they feel comfortable discussing the issues. Some felt that, you know, case studies sometimes help. But again, the emphasis was on good teachers, you know, that can provide a comfortable environment for young people where they can discuss issues.
Yeah, you've alluded to this, which is the fact that it would appear that workbooks are the main methodology being used in the classroom in SPHE, whereas in fact students would far prefer class discussion and debates. Now, have you any views, I mean, do we have any idea why it is that teachers don't seem to favour, or rather don't seem to carry out debates? And, you know, do you think it suggests perhaps that teachers aren't taking SPHE as seriously as they might?
I think the problem it is, this is something I and a lot of other members of the council felt in their schools, was that usually the younger teachers are put in charge of teaching subjects like SBHE. And if you're in first year, you probably get a different teacher every year for the same subjects. So teachers are constantly on the rotate, because a lot of teachers don't feel like, you know, they actually want to teach this subject. So they're just put there and they have to do it. Whereas I feel that if a teacher is kind of, you know, if they value the subject, they would obviously teach it better and they would understand young people in a better way. So yes, I think there is a major problem with the way it is being implemented. And it is a shame because what we found out is that, you know, the teachers are constantly being trained. And if the teachers are rotating in schools, new teachers are going to have to be trained. So resources are being spent on teaching, you know, teachers constantly on, and these resources, you know, could be put on something much better.
Right. Let's turn, if we might, I do apologise for interrupting you, let's turn, if we might, to relationships and sexuality education. And I imagine the casual reader coming to this survey will be surprised at the low numbers of students who say they had RSE classes in their schools during 2009.
Surprised we were as well. 70% of the students that we surveyed said that they weren't getting RSE classes in 2009. And there was a major national study carried out in 2007 where teachers and principals were surveyed on the same topic that we are surveying young people now. And in their survey, they said that, you know, 48% of Leaving Cert students weren't getting RSE, meaning, you know, 51% were getting it. Whereas what we found out is that 74% didn't get RSE. So there is a big mismatch between what the teachers and principals survey said and what young people's survey is saying this at this moment.
Sheelan, just to close on this question, if we might, obviously there has been a certain amount of controversy regarding RSE for many, many years now. There'll always be some people who would suggest that these are matters to be dealt with by parents in the home. Given that it is indeed in schools, albeit not to what you would regard as a sufficient extent, do you think parents have any right to be consulted regarding the content of the RSE that is taught in schools?
I think RSE at senior cycle, I mean, it is being taught to people over the age of 16. And in this country, once you turn 16, once you turn 17, you have, you know, freedom to work, you have freedom to get a driving license, you have so many responsibilities. And I think if you're given the opportunity to you know, do all these things, you should be given the freedom to get all the information you require as well. So I think at that age, parents should not be allowed to have as much of an influence as they might have at the moment on what is being taught in RSE curriculum. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, a young person at the age of 16, 17 or 18 is exposed to so many things outside of school anyway, and parents can't have as much control on them as they would at a younger age.
And Barry Hennessy will be back at the same time next week with more education news. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. You can hear podcasts of previous programmes on www.insideed.com, and you can contact us by email on insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Next on the programme, we consider the impact on our lives and on education of the huge amount of information that confronts us daily. The internet, email, chat rooms, discussion boards, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, not to mention mobile phones and so on, are technologies, terms and brands that meant little to many of us a decade or two ago. Today, they are parts of daily life for many of us. The proliferation of such media can be overwhelming at times, interrupting other activities and demanding our immediate attention. David Schenk calls this information data smog, and he wrote a book on the topic. I spoke to David about his book and about the implications of data smog for education. This interview was recorded in April 2001, but despite that, what David Schenk had to say then could easily have been said today. I began the interview by asking David, what is data smog?
What is data smog? Well, data smog is the streams of data and stimulus and information and attention getting that we don't want. It's the things that we refer to as distractions, or we consider distractions. It's the sense that in a kind of slightly larger sense, it's this sense that more and more of us have now that we're in a world where you know, it's wonderful that we can reach anyone and anyone can reach us, and that we've got all these, you know, electronic devices, and there are obvious advantages to being in this world, but there's also this sense of being just completely overwhelmed by the contacts that never seem to stop.
So you're talking about the information that comes from advertising, from television, from radio, from the internet. Is that right?
That's right. From all those commercial sources and from all your friends and your friends' friends. And, you know, I mean, one of the strange things that's happened in the last couple of years, and I think, again, mostly it's a mostly wonderful thing, but it's strange and it has this weird downside, is that most of us have joined the media. Most of us have become members of the media, just like any, you know, reporter is a member of the media, in the sense that we can contact people. We can send stuff out via email or via cell phone or fax or whatever, and we can reach people rather easily. And what I'm trying to say mostly in this book is that, yeah, let's take these new tools and these new opportunities, but let's also realize that there are trade-offs and there are responsibilities that come with these new powers.
So what kind of trade-offs are involved, David?
Well, I think, you know, with every new tool, with every new opportunity, with every new kind of twist of your life, there seems to be, if you look hard enough, there seems to be, you know, something that you like about it, if indeed you know this is something that you asked for, and there's also something that you give up about your old life that maybe you miss. And it's usually the case if you've asked for this new thing that it's worth it. The trade-off is worth it. But the trade-off still exists. And sometimes we live in this kind of, you know, world of ambivalence where it's wonderful to have these new tools. It's wonderful, for example, to be able to email anyone at any time and send out a note to all, you know, 50 of your friends at the same time. But it's not so wonderful sometimes to be the recipient of, say, 500 emails a day, which more and more of my friends are finding. And it's not so wonderful to be, it's wonderful to have this thing that we call, at least in the United States, call waiting, where your phone call can be interrupted so you're never going to miss a call. But it's also a drag to have virtually all of your conversations in life interrupted by, you know, whether you're on the phone via call waiting or you know, in some other venue and have, you know, something else try to get your attention. So the trade-offs are that we are increasingly flagged down. Our attention is flagged by people who we know and people we don't know. And we live in a world of increasing distraction.
In the book, David, you talk about technological utopianism. You say, ever on the horizon sits a wondrous technology promising to deliver a truly equitable, educated, civil, democratic society. Now, are you saying that the internet, and computers in particular, are not going to give us a more educated and a more equitable and civil society?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think... it's fair to say the jury's still out. I don't know whether or not this latest set of technologies are going to give us a more just world, a more equitable world. But I do know that on the whole, I do believe in progress through technology. I believe that society has benefited from, you know, a virtually unlimited list now of tools going back hundreds or thousands of years. The rather fine line that I try to dance on sometimes, I try not to come off as nostalgic, because I'm not saying that I want to go back to any particular era and give up the things that we have. I'm acknowledging, both personally and professionally, I'm acknowledging all the advantages of having these new tools. But I'm also saying, again, that there are these trade-offs. So equity, justice... I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, don't assume that these things are going to happen. Don't assume, don't believe the people who are in charge of, whose job it is to sell you this hyped message that this tool, because it's so fantastic, will make your life fantastic or will make society fantastic. It doesn't work that way automatically, as anyone would realize if you stop and just kind of break down the message and think skeptically for a little while.
And why then are some people, say educators, governments in particular, so easily seduced by the lure of the internet in ways that they aren't by other educational materials?
That's a great question. There is something magical about about the internet. It's given us things that we really couldn't have even conceived of before. And the power, the opportunity and the power that it gives us as individuals and as little groups and schools to go out and bypass these, you know, traditional sources of information, these these traditional powers that can decide what we access and what we don't access. It's a pretty fantastic thing. I think the seduction is partly just in the thrill of the electronic razzle dazzle. I think anyone who's been on the internet and sees that you can, that someone in Brooklyn, New York, can access a homepage that was made by someone in Dublin, Ireland, and just as easily access a homepage that was made by someone in Jerusalem. And of course, who knows where the servers are? It doesn't matter. That's the whole point, is that we've shrunk down electronically. We've shrunk down this world so that we can travel virtually anywhere, keyword virtually, at any time. So I think that's part of it. I think it's the electronic seduction. Another key part of it is that there is so much money behind this message, marketing this message to schools, coming from companies starting with Microsoft and then going down the list, that that is trying to convince people that, you know, the best thing they can do for themselves, for their kids, for their communities, for their country, is to wire everything as soon as possible. And implicit in that message, or usually explicit actually, is this message. It's kind of this undertow message that says, if you don't do that soon, if you don't wire your schools, well, you're falling behind the other guy. And I think there's that fear factor that's really playing into this.
Because with regard to computers and schools, you describe technology as a kind of junk food, that people love it, but there's no nutrition to speak of. Do you think then it's a mistake to be putting computers and the internet in particular into schools and into classrooms?
I think it's a mistake to do it as quickly as we're doing it, first of all, because we have, my understanding is there are no studies at all that show conclusively that a computerized classroom has an advantage over a non-computerized classroom. Remember that these computers may be powerful and they may be cheap relatively to what they used to be, but we're still talking about a lot of money for hardware. We're talking about the complexity of putting in the system, of maintaining the system, of teaching the system to teachers. So, you know, there are resources that this takes. There's all sorts of anecdotes now that certain, you know, that old fashioned teachers are being laid off so they can make room for the technology managers that have to come into schools to manage this stuff. And I just don't think the evidence is in. I think without a doubt, it's very clear, at least to me personally, that every school should have an internet connection in the library, because the internet is the most fantastic addition to the idea of the library that, you know, that we've seen in a long, long time. I mean, to be able to as an information research resource, it's just spectacular. And as I experience that every day as a writer and researcher. But I think the idea of taking that one step further and giving every kid a laptop or wiring every classroom, I'm just not sure that we know that that's a good thing yet. And I think once we, you know, rushing into it does have all sorts of consequences.
And if you take that argument then of having a computer and having an internet connection in the library, where do you draw the line, and where do you say that the harmful effects or the negative effects start to come into the use of computers in schools?
Well, you know, we're starting to get into this area where I'm don't even want to pretend to be an expert, because I'm not an educator, and it's been a while since I've been in a classroom on either end. So I mean, I think that you have to take these things, you know, as they come, and you have to deal with, you know, with the particulars of the age level and the teacher's proficiency and, you know, all sorts of other variables that are going to be different in every school. But I think, you know, the principle that I would use is, certainly it's a given that these things can be useful as research tools. And as long as teachers and librarians know what they're getting into, because putting a kid on the internet is giving them access to just a spectacular and somewhat frightening amount of information, which has, as I say, brings its own, special burdens with it. So as long as they know what they're getting into there, I think that, that's not something that we need to be too wary of. But the idea of really transforming an awfully old tradition of teaching between a teacher and students and turning that into some sort of super electronic classroom where students and teacher are really sharing more electronically than they are verbally, where kids have access to the internet in the classroom. I mean, one kind of basic philosophical problem with that idea is that when you think about it, schools are there to educate, but that's not the same as saying that they're there to plug kids into an information stream. Education is actually mostly about keeping information out. It's about being very selective about the little tiny nuggets of information that a child, a student, should have access to at any given time. And of course, the key there is context. It's what did they learn the day before? How what are they already familiar with in their lives? And how are we going to take this new, life lesson or historical lesson or scientific lesson and plug it into what they already know so that they can make sense of it? That is mostly an exercise in keeping information out and very, very careful editing of what is said and what is written, what is read, what is given out as handouts, and what is asked of the students in terms of homework. So in a way, the internet is the opposite. Putting a kid on the internet is the opposite of what we think of as education. And while I say I've already said it's certainly appropriate as a research tool in many ways, it's not. We can't equate putting kids into this information stream with the idea of education.
Yeah, that's very interesting, David. You also in the book say, you implicitly say, I suppose, that teachers are in danger of losing credibility because children's attention spans are reduced and they're only really convinced by the as you say, the razzle-dazzle images on MTV or on video games. So does it mean that teachers and the role of teachers needs to be redefined given that there are all these more attractive messages than what a teacher may be giving to children?
I expect that the teacher's role will be redefined because, we're having this discussion in the context of, communities that have access to the internet. So, putting aside the question of, communities that don't yet have access, can't afford it, et cetera, which is a separate issue. But, assuming that we're in a climate where most people can get access to the internet, either at some kind of public institution like a library or at home, which is increasingly the case in the industrialized world. I think that there's no question but that the teacher's role is going to be changed because just by virtue of what these teachers' students are seeing from day to day. I mean, when I was 20 years ago, when I was in grade school, coming to school, I had a little shelf of books and we had a world books, set of world book encyclopedias, and I had my parents and my, other family members as resources, and I had my limited experience in the world, and I brought that to school. Well, now a sixth grader, or an eighth grader, or a tenth grader is coming to school with, once they've had access to the internet, once they're emailing friends and friends' friends and strangers all over the world and chatting with those people virtually and accessing their web pages, either as a matter of sport or entertainment or just curiosity, they're bringing a new wealth of experience and knowledge and maybe even wisdom to the classroom. And they're going to be expecting their teacher to take that into account. I mean, I would imagine that in some of the communities where kids are better I don't know, you know, where kids are encouraged to be curious, and where there's a real climate of curiosity in the air, that kids are, you know, sixth graders now come to school with some pretty tough questions and some pretty terrific challenges for teachers. You know, if they've had a real basic science lesson, they've gone home and kind of, you know, played with it on the internet and done some research and found out that maybe the teacher didn't get it quite right, or part of the, you know, part of the story is really missing there. Or, I imagine that there's some really interesting things going on, and I think that I would imagine that the better teachers are going to respond really affirmatively to that, that they're going to love the fact that these kids are showing curiosity, and hopefully they won't be shut down for their curiosity. Hopefully they'll, you know, they'll be encouraged for that.
David, we're coming near the end. The subtitle of your book is Surviving the Information Glut. So you are ultimately hopeful, it seems, about the development. How can we survive and live happily and productively in a world so full of images and messages?
Gee, how much time do I have? the key to surviving this stuff, the key to navigating it in a successful way, is inevitably a very personal question. I mean, you know, I could go on for hours about how I've, you know, tried to live in a world that's rich in information and rich in possibility of contact, but also try to maintain my serenity and my sanity. I think really the first and most important thing is that you take a step back and look at the tools you use, look at the way you're interacting with information and with other people, and try to make at least a mental list of the advantages and the drawbacks, the benefits and the trade-offs, and maybe you'll realize that you don't like one or two of those trade-offs so much, and that it's not worth it in some cases. Maybe you'll realize that you know, that 10 hours a day on email or 18 hours a day checking your email does something to you that you don't like, that you're giving up some quiet space and some moments of reflection that you used to really value in your life and help kept you balanced. I've certainly discovered that about myself, and I've taken steps so that while not quitting email, while certainly rejoicing in I make sure that a part of my day is separate from virtually all electronic contact, so that I've got this kind of peace of mind where I can pick up a book and read a chapter and not only not get interrupted, but not feel the thrill of wanting to be interrupted. And I think if people take a step back and just have a fairly sober examination of these tools, then they don't need an expert to come along and give them you know, all these specific prescriptions. What they need is just that nudge to take that consideration and to make reasonable judgments.
And that was David Schenck. David Schenck's book is called Data Smog: Surviving the Information Glut, and it was published in 1997, and a very well-written book it is. That's all we have time for on this week's programme. If you want to hear podcasts of this or previous programmes, you can download them from iTunes or directly from our website, which is www.insideed.com. That website address again is insideed.com. You can text us on the program. Our number is 086-8962-665. You can also email the program at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to Barry Hennessy for the news report. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Stand by for Ali and Emmett with Up and Down, the Urban Music Show. We'll be right back.